love you.
Welcome to Voices of the Frontline segment on the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at kpfk.org. My name is Damon Azali Rojas, and today I'll be speaking with one of my favorite guests, one of my favorite Voices from the Frontline's guests for the whole entire hour. None other than the OG prison abolitionist, Dr. Ruth Wilson Gilmore. The topic, her new handbook for fighters of the prison police state, Golden Gulag, Prison Surplus, Crisis, and Opposition in Globalizing California. Ruthie, are you on the phone?
I'm right here. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, OG, yeah.
OG, original...
Go-getter.
So I just actually wanted to start off the show just kind of talking a little bit about how you might not have known, but you've kind of changed my life. Back in 1989, or 1998 actually, in Berkeley, California, there was a conference called the Critical Resistance Conference Beyond the Prison Industrial Complex, of which Ruthie's organization, or one of her organizations, Critical Resistance, started, sponsored it. I went to it for about 3 hours, and I think it was a three-day conference, but 3 hours for me just like totally rearranged my head. Going into the actual conference, I'm like walking in. I think there was like 1,500, 3,000. How many people were there?
About 3,000, 3,500.
Were they there in the first day where Pan-Africa was speaking?
There were at least 2,000 people there arriving,
okay.
And there were 1,500 or 1,800 in that room, yes.
I knew it was a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in my particular, you know, political stance at that point, just kind of mad at things and why black people are being criminalized, whatever, but not knowing why. To get into that room, we're hearing, you know, 2,000 people pumping their fists saying, you know, on a move with Pan-Africa, just like, I was like, oh my God, I'm home. And that actually led me to become an organizer, to come back to LA to actually get trained as an organizer, and that's the organization I'm with now. The Labor Community Strategy Center has a national school for organizers, and I went into it, and now I'm actually teaching in it, and I'm also the lead organizer for the Community Rights Campaign, which is dealing with a lot of the same issues around criminalization and whatnot. So Ruthie, just start off, I want to thank you and the other CR comrades that are listening for helping me out there.
You're so welcome. And it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's all about bringing, you know, bright and energetic people like you to the front, and mainly helping people of all ages realize there is something that everyone can do, because this situation is so awful and so overwhelming that sometimes people feel crushed by hopelessness. And having some hope is central to getting out of these machines for human sacrifice, which is what prisons are.
That's right. So, the whole OG part means you've been doing this for a long time in terms of kind of being an organizer and an activist against the kind of prison, the prison system. And so within that, clearly this book is a tactic in that long-term strategy to take the bricks out of the prisons and to free people and whatnot. So I guess I want to start off in terms of the book, Golden Gulag. Who is your audience, and what are your objectives in terms of the book, where you want to bring your audience to at the end of it?
My audience is all different kinds of people, and anyone who's picked up the book and just leafed through it will see that it's pitched in a bunch of different ways. In every chapter, I use the same kind of intensity to try to say what I'm trying to help people think through, but I use a bunch of different approaches to help people see how so many things are connected. So I've written a book so that people who are interested in political economy and who are labor organizers and who are trying to figure out how come Los Angeles and places like Los Angeles changed so much over the past 25 years can get a lot of detail about that. And if that chapter isn't for you and you want to know how people in communities that have been affected by saturation policing and criminalization organize themselves without any particularly special stuff at hand except for the will and the desire and the hope to get more fairness for their loved ones' lives, then Chapter 5 is for you. And if you want to know about the state and how it made its decisions on a prison expansion, then it's Chapter 3 and so forth. So I also, in trying to cover a lot of material in not a lot of pages, that book looks longer than it is, I also spent a lot of time talking about the situation in rural California and where the new prisons have gone. And the reason I did that was I wanted the audience, people who are thinking about, well, what do we do to connect urban and rural? And for people in rural areas to say, what do we do if we don't want all these prisons? And we're tired of our kids being criminalized and so forth. So I had a lot of audiences in mind. And for that reason, I think that the editor at the press was driven a little crazy. But after a while, you know, he and others really helped me, you know, when I said, no, I really need this to be here. I need all these things. So maybe to kind of sum all that up, since I really believe with all my heart and soul that prison is at the middle of all the contradictions that face the supermajority of the world today, right, working people around the world, that's most of the people on the planet, then the reason my book is somewhat complicated is so people can find all different ways to get to that problem so that they can work back out to where they're already at and figure out what they can do in their communities, in their organizations, and so forth to find solutions.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot of material and not a lot of pages. Because I remember I got to the end of, I think, Chapter 5 or uh-huh. the epilogue around the other bus, uh-huh. and I realized that there was this whole section about notes.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just telling you, people should just get the book for the notes section because it goes through, there's like, I think, a page and a half a thing about Marxist rage exploitation, like explained in a page and a half. And so I was like, oh, that's why it's so thick. Because I was like, oh, man, I got so much more to read. But I saw all those different things in terms of all the different ways that people can kind of grasp it. And I think toward the end, I want to get into what are some of those connections and how can every different issue group fight around the prison industrial complex. But before we get there, last week when I talked to you, we were talking a little bit about you kind of traveling up and down California and different book talks you were doing and whatnot. And, you know, there's a couple types of people, and I want to kind of talk about the progressive end of that spectrum, and because I think, you know, most of our listeners are on that, unless they're trying to peep game from the other side. But I want to just you to talk about some of the normal questions that you get that, you know, might actually be cut against what normal progressive thought is around prison system in terms of who, where the prison town situated or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's a really good question, Damon, and the answer is a bit surprising. Just as everything I've done in rural California and around the rural United States where prisons have gone has surprised me. So here's a contrast. People out there listening, listen to this. In urban places, when I get up and talk about prisons and so forth, generally one of the first questions I get is, what are you going to do about the murders, the child molesters, and the racists? As though everyone in prison were in those categories, and as though those categories were the same as each other, and as though in most cases, most people should not, for any reason, spend part of all their lives in cages, whatever they've done. So that's in the urban context. In the rural context, you would think that that would also be the lead question, too. What about, you know, the murderous child, rapists and child molesters? Uh-uh. In the rural context, people get up and say, we think there are ways to solve this problem without building prisons. And I don't mean the lefties in rural California. I mean ordinary people who work really hard, who, having fought against prison after prison after prison in their community, trying to come to their community, have actually gotten to thinking about root causes and how those root causes can be addressed. So I get prosperous Republican farmers saying there are alternatives. And that's very interesting to me.
Wow. That is kind of interesting. And so I mean, what do you what explains that difference, really?
What does explain the difference? I haven't quite figured it all out, but I think that part of what explains the difference is this. Throughout the media, regardless of where you live, you know, you see the same fox, whether you live in the country or the city. We're bombarded all the time with news of horror and disaster. And, of course, a terrible thing happened at Virginia Tech, and we will hear about it constantly. And I don't mean to diminish the sorrow of those who lost people or the horrible loss of life. But the fact is we're going to hear about it endlessly, endlessly. It appears to me that for some reason in rural communities, I don't know if because they're smaller, people feel a little bit less alienated from these various kinds of relationships that they have culturally in their community, on the streets, at the workplace, and so forth. Folks get all that stuff in, but they have a way of thinking differently about neighborhoods, I think, as well as thinking differently about what ordinary people are able to do with their energy if they put their time and energy into something. I think that's part of it. I also think part of it is that in rural communities, people have in some ways been experiencing somewhat sharper contradictions. For example, when they're struggling against employers, there aren't, 25,000 employers, there are 4. And so the relations of production are more clearly not relations that can be attributed to the bad or inhumane choices of a single employer, and one should just go to another employer, but they can see because there are a few employers that it's systemic. So I think those are a couple of reasons why. And the third one is that people in rural America who have fought against prison after prison after prison have asked themselves, what's going on in urban America where these prisoners are coming from that could be addressed and isn't? And so they've done some research. So those are some answers to a difficult question.
So, I mean, I think just going more into the kind of rural and urban kind of debate. One of the things around the first chapter you spoke about is about the political economy of California. And I think it really taught me a lot because I always knew the urban setting of shifting in point of deindustrialization of like heavy industry, particularly in relation to like what was happening before the Watts rebellions and in black communities and whatnot. But I think the one thing that I didn't have a good handle on before I read your book was the shifts in rural areas that led to the kind of creation of Prison Alley, right? So All these prisons built in the middle of the state. And I think what I think I would like you to do is actually speak to the fact of like, what were the shifts in production in the economy and industry that seeded the 2 decades of prison construction?
In the rural case?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, what happened in the Central Valley, in the Great San Joaquin Valley, which is where most of the new prisons have been built, is that a combination of debt and droughts and disaster led some pretty large landowners to get rid of some land, but more importantly, it led some very large industrial agriculturalists to figure out how to cut costs by cutting wages. And this also happened in the urban context. So this is where the experiences of people in urban and rural California mirror each other. Because while rural California might be characterized mostly, although not exclusively, by small towns and small town life, agriculture in California, like all resource extraction in California, has been huge and hugely industrialized in most of the state for most of the last 100-plus years. What that means is that most of the people who work in agriculture are not self-exploiting farmers and their families, but rather wage laborers. And in the early 80s, after a long period of first drought and then disastrous rain, pushed some very large agriculturalists to the brink of or into bankruptcy, what they did to try to get out of bankruptcy was to cut costs by cutting wages. And the way they tried to cut wages was to lay off all the farm workers who worked for them and then hire them back through contractors. So that's not unlike what happens here in the city around sweatshops, for example, or what happened 25 years ago with janitorial services that had been well organized dominated by African American men. They all got laid off, and then contractors brought in immigrant workers to do those jobs. So back to rural California, in this mix of debt and disaster and drought, when these agriculturalists tried to go head-to-head with the workers, they saw that none other than the United Farm Workers and other formerly very successful labor organizers were going to come into town and take them on. And so the sort of political elites of the towns decided to turn to prison as an industry of last resort to displace the activism and the organizing around wages and say, here, our wages are going down. Let's bring in a new industry. It hires modestly educated men and women like you all. You can get jobs over there and it'll all be good. So that's, in a nutshell, what happened.
And so then, by extension, in terms of why would these towns actually want to have a prison? Because, I mean, in your book, you actually talk about that.
Mm-hmm. So why prison? Why didn't they say, let's get back office work for a credit card company?
Or, right.
You know, the other kinds of things.
There's definitely enough credit card companies to...
In rural America.
Yeah.
Well, part of it has to do with, you know, if you think about it, political elites, like economic elites, are not as footloose as we like to think they are. They have a lot of power. They have the capacity to make other people do things they otherwise wouldn't do on their own, but they can't do just anything. So the question is, in what ways were these political elites embedded in circuits of power, and in what ways were they able to turn to the capacity of certain kinds of developers to bring something to their town? So these agriculturalists, while powerful in Sacramento, because farmers, although not representing a large part of the state product, still represent large parts of the state, they could talk to people in Sacramento, which had just been, you know, talking about and planning to go on this prison building binge, which was supposed to result in lots of prisons being built right here in L.A. They turned, therefore, to prisons because prisons were available in the circuits of power where they already traveled, right? They didn't know how to contact Chase and get a back office. That's why they turned to prisons. And also, they turned to prisons because they had towns that didn't have a lot of the sorts of amenities that perhaps more attractive industries that were suburbanizing or moving to the exurbs might have been looking for.
So, I mean, part of this whole kind of thing, if you talk about the timeline that you're actually talking about, if you're talking about it, I think I looked in the book, it's in 1977, there were only 19,600 people in prison in California.
Mm-hmm.
Opposed to now, where we have, I think, almost 170,000.
A little more than that now.
A little more than that.
Every minute.
Right. Tick tock, you know.
Exactly.
A smoker dies and black person, Latino person gets locked up.
Exactly.
So in terms of that, there's this whole thing about where did the tough on crime rhetoric come from? Because I know, you know, now it's like the mayor of L.A. is doing this. You know, anybody who's anybody, left, right, center, I mean, say not left because there's not really politicians that are left at this particular point, but I wanted to read a little piece out of your book on page 95 that actually speaks to kind of where some of this began. So it goes back to Duke Majian's gubernatorial opponent, Tom Bradley, as mayor of Los Angeles, successfully controlled the rising share of the city budget that the LAPD and the police and fire pension fund had commanded for more than a decade. The police fought back by campaigning statewide in uniform for Duke Majian. Duke Majian seized the issue and used the L.A. dispute to project race, crime, and the need for state building as a single issue, claiming that the African-American mayor tightening of the LAPD budget could only be the work of a man that was soft on crime.
Mm-hmm.
So once Duke Majian took office in 1983, the administration brought in Jerry Brown's new prison plan, and he was talking about more about rehabilitation,
mm-hmm.
but dropped the rehabilitation as a reason for the new buildings. With punishment in the form of incapacitation, now the rationale for prison, the administration, the legislature, and the California Department of Corrections joined forces to expand the state's built capacity for incarceration. But the state still had two immediate problems. First, how to better guarantee potential prisoners, and second, how to finance the cages that they were going to put them in. So first, let's talk about how did they actually guarantee the prisoner part of it.
To guarantee the prisoner part of it, having again, decided to build the prisons, I want to emphasize that to listeners, having decided to build the prisons, then they guaranteed the prisoners by passing law after law after law that either created new crimes or added time to crimes already on the books, and added time in really inflexible ways in the form of mandatory minimum sentencing. So three strikes is the most notable of the mandatory minimum sentencing laws in the state, but it's not the only one. There are lots of them. In fact, from 88 forward, the state was in such a frenzy of making and reviewing new criminal legislation that the justice committees of the two chambers of the legislature spun off standalone committees on public safety that would just deal with criminal legislation. Because remember, folks who are listening, there's all this other legislation that happens, right? That's not all about crime. And there's even other justice legislation that has to do with civil justice. So they had to spin off specialized entities that would just deal with criminal law, and they started working once a week, every week, to review and put forward to the General Assembly and the State Senate law after law after law. So that's
how many laws were
they? They passed. I stopped counting after a while, but they passed more than 2,000 new pieces of legislation, either creating new crimes or adding time to crimes already on the books. And let me tell you an example, a story of one time that I watched them doing this. A group of people who are described pretty well in the prologue of my book went to Sacramento to sit before this committee on public safety to try to persuade them to refer to the Senate floor, this was the Senate Committee on Public Safety, one law proposing a very, very weak review of the three strikes law. It was basically, would you be willing to vote to review the law to see if it is being applied equally and without consideration of race, ethnicity, or place of residence, because we were all pretty convinced that that wouldn't be the case. And so we sat through all the hearings of all the laws before we finally got to the discussion about the proposal that Families to Amend California's Three Strikes had persuaded former state senator John Vasconcelos to introduce. During the discussion of one of the earlier bills, the talk went like this. The bill had to do with some kind of white-collar crime, some kind of using computers and the Internet to do X, Y, or Z would become a felony. And so they were discussing it, and the sponsor of the bill was standing at the lectern, you know, explaining his bill and what its strengths were. And Senator Vasconcelos just said in a very offhanded way, you realize that this would become a strikeable offense, i.e., that anybody charged under this white-collar crime would be eligible then to be put into the hopper of three strikes. And without missing a beat, the sponsor of the law and other people in the discussion said, well, actually, then we should make it a misdemeanor, right? Which is to say, take this white-collar offense, which presumably would be, you know, perpetrated by white people or at least people of higher socioeconomic status than people who get caught up in three strikes, take them out of the running to be struck. And it was stunning to us sitting in the audience watching them do this as though they were just saying, it's time for lunch, let's take a break. Yeah, and it was just, and we all sat there talking among ourselves, did you see that? Did you see them make a law for white people? We watched them do that.
Whereas in the other case, you actually speak in your book about the thing called a wobbler,
yeah,
which are things that are misdemeanors, but then basically district attorneys are encouraged to actually make them felonies and
right,
switch them over. The ones that are the laws for the black people.
Right, right. And And, you know, and as the mothers in Chapter 5 talk about it, they understood. You know, they had a long talk about it, and they understood that certainly black people could commit that white-collar crime and only get a misdemeanor. And certainly there are plenty of other people of color who are not black and poor white people who've been caught up under three strikes. But what the mothers saw and what we saw sitting in that assembly room that day was, you know, the sort of the making of laws that followed two tracks, one normatively, if not empirically, white, and the other normatively, if not empirically, black. That's what we saw. And in fact, when Senator Vasconcelos said this would make it strikeable, he brought that up because he was the one who was going to introduce the bill, as I said earlier, to try to change three strikes. And so he brought it up to try to get people to start to recognize the absurdity of three strikes. But that's not how they took his comment. They took his comment as a caution,
as a
they merely rewrote their law.
Right, right. So this is Damon Azali Rojas with Dr. Ruthie Gilmore, talking about her new book, Golden Gulag. And I want to take one more question before we go to break, and I think it's the other half of the question. So one, it was, how do we guarantee, how did this, after the state of California decided they wanted to build prisons as a fix to, you know, help build the economy, they, you know, we just talked about how they helped fill it. But then on the other side around the financing, which is continuing to come up today with Governor Schwarzenegger, you know, how did they actually finance these to actually be built, the prisons?
Okay. All right, we'll get back to it.
No, before we go.
Oh, before we go.
Yeah,
I'm
before
sorry.
We go.
I thought we were going to break, and then I was going to say that.
No.
Okay, let me talk about that. In the first few years of the prison building boom, the state did was it went to the voters. And the reason it went to the voters is it's required by law to go to the voters. When a public entity in the state of California borrows money that we all pledge our full faith and credit to repay, meaning we'll pay that back even if we don't have enough money to buy a quart of milk, we have to be asked our permission. So that's what the state did at the outset. It asked permission of the voters. May we pledge the full faith and credit of the state of California to build prison after prison after prison?
And then this would be the general obligation bonds.
Exactly.
Much so like just folks who voted in the last election, all the 1A, B, C, D, all those were general obligation bonds.
Yes. And voters said yes. But it was pretty clear to people who were paying attention to the mood of voters in the 1980s when when the economic landscape went through lots of changes all the time, that voters would not continue to say yes. They were going to start to feel that they had said yes enough and that they would want to do other things, including not spend any money at all, possibly. So what happened was some people put their heads together in the mid-1980s and said, what are we going to do when the voters say no? Let's get ready. Let's have an exit plan here. And what they decided was that they could put together basically a shell game to make it look like prisons produced revenue and therefore were self-financing institutions. Now, let me explain to listeners what that means. If the state of California borrows money and builds college dormitories with it, that's a self-financing project because the students paying their rent on their dorm rooms will pay off the loan, right? Or when you use a highway, you pay for it either with a toll or with a tax at the gas pump, right? Those are self-financing projects. There is no income when it comes to prisons. So what the state did was it set up this shell game where they said one entity is the Public Works Board that owns the prison, and the Department of Corrections is the entity that rents the prison. And so they entered into this fiction that the Department of Corrections renting the prison was like a college student renting a dorm room, and that the money was somehow coming from outside, and therefore it would be okay to borrow billions of dollars without asking the voters under the guise that these were not projects that were pledging the full faith and credit of the state of California, even though they do. So that's how they got around the problem of financing, and that's exactly what today, Governor Schwarzenegger and the Guards Union wants to do to raise $11 billion to build 78,000 new beds.
Quite a show game. Quite a show game. So, again, we're talking to Ruthie Gilmore about our new book, Golden Gulag. And this is Damon Azali Rojas on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. When we come back from the break, I want to play, there's actually a song that I want to play, about a minute of it, because I think it really applies to what we're talking about today. It's from The Last Poets. So we'll go back to break, and we'll be right back with Ruthie Gilmore.